Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton, author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and you are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, editorial director of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. On today's show, we have one of our rare interviews with a guy. It's restaurateur Ken Friedman, one of my favorite people in the business. He's business partners with Chef April Bloomfield. He actually managed the Smiths back in the 80s, and he's the only person who has crashed our Jubilee conference. We couldn't kick him out because he showed up with Alice Waters. Rolling in with Alice entitles you to a pass.
Yep.
Before we talk to Ken, I'd like to thank our sponsor, Kerrygold. Kerrygold's pure Irish butter is made with milk from grass-fed cows. The rich, nuanced flavor makes it perfect for all your baking and cooking needs. It's a taste that says 1,000 words, including, it's the bomb. People have already asked me if Kerrygold sponsored the show because my name is Carrie. I guess that makes sense. I don't think they did, but if that's the case, I owe my mom a commission. Today's guest is the co-owner and restaurateur behind The Spotted Pig, The Breslin, Tosca, Locanda Verde, Salvation Taco, Salvation Burger, The Monkey Bar, and the brand new butcher shop White Gold. Ken has been a great supporter of female talent in the industry, and we're thrilled to welcome him to Radio Cherry Bomb. Ken, welcome.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for the welcome. Thanks. Nice to be here.
Absolutely. We're psyched to have you here. Where do we even begin? There's so much to talk about with you.
Well, White Gold Butchers we should talk about because that's our newest place. And
you just got 2 stars from the New York Times.
Yeah, that was cool. That was really cool.
So White Gold is your butcher shop and restaurant on the Upper West Side.
Yeah.
New territory for you.
April and I decided we wanted to do a restaurant outside of New York, so we did it on the Upper West Side. We started looking around and found this commissary for this place called Risotteria. That they had a bunch of stores, and they had their commissary. Their main one was on the Upper West Side. And it's a great neighborhood. And we went up there, and it's like full of people and women pushing strollers. And
as Pete Wells pointed out, they need stuff like this up there. Why the name White Gold?
That's what butchers call the fat that marbles in meat. Like when you get a steak with beautiful marbled fat, that's white gold. That's what butchers call it.
And speaking of butchers, Erica and Jocelyn, tell me about your two. So they're butchers and co-owners. So
yeah.
They're partners in this project.
They're partners.
Which is great.
I mean, they deserve to be partners. They would have gone and done it without us, you know, eventually. They would have figured out how to raise the money and stuff. Erica did it before with Lindy and Grundy in L.A., you know. They just deserve to be our partners, you know. And, I mean, again, we wanted to, like, take them off the market. So we sort of made a deal with them where we said one of them, it ended up being Erica, we asked to set up the butcher program at the Breslin. Because we sell, you know, a couple hundred lamb burgers a day at the Breslin. So we, same thing, April wanted to, like, control, you know, do it ourselves. So she set up a whole butcher program in the Ace Hotel downstairs, which is a cool kind of butcher room. And then Erica, I mean, Jocelyn, her girlfriend and partner, worked with us on Salvation Burger. So she set up the whole butcher program there while we were all looking for the right commissary, like what I was saying. So
these two have been part of your universe for a little while. You know, we could stop talking about meat for a minute so I don't lose our entire vegan audience. But I said in the beginning that you have been such a great supporter of female talent. You know, partnering with April, partnering with Erica and Jocelyn, you know, April's kitchens are filled with women. It's great. And it shouldn't be remarkable. I shouldn't have to sit here and, like, commend you for doing that. But not all guy restaurateurs are like you.
Well, look, first of all, if Erica and Jocelyn had been guys, we would have, I mean, it's weird to say that because they're not. But, but you know, I don't think either of us look at somebody and say, you know, you win because you're a woman over the, you know, whoever's the most qualified. But I think one thing is, like, I went from the music business to the restaurant business, and I thought about it for a long time. And one of the things, you know, I was in punk rock bands way back when I was in college and after college. And I've always been kind of like, I want to do whatever the mainstream is doing, I want to do the opposite. I've always been that way with everything from music to clothes to food. So one of the things I wanted to do when I was thinking for many, many years about doing my first restaurant was like, what do I want to do different than every other restaurateur does in New York? I was living in the West Village then. And every restaurant had male chefs. Every head chef was a man. There were no women chefs that were, I mean, there were women chefs, but nobody that like owned the restaurant and got any press. This is 2014 is when we opened, 2004 is when we opened the Spotted Pig. So I kind of, just to be kind of punk rock, I wanted a woman because it was all, and Mario Batali was my sort of chef friend that was helping me. And he kept presenting me with these guys that they all used to work for him. Or they all used to work for, you know, John George or Danielle. And I was like, I don't want just some guy that used to work for Mario. That's not sexy. I want like a British chef or a woman chef. And I ended up finding a British woman.
Because you knew you wanted a gastropub.
Yeah. Right? I knew that great art is made by people for themselves, not for anybody else. So I wanted a place that I wanted to go. And I was a guy that loved bars. I loved great food. And I couldn't figure out why the hell there was never great food in bars, and there were hardly ever great bars and restaurants. So I thought, I didn't set out to call it a gastropub, even though I was aware of what gastropubs were. I just wanted to like buy the White Horse Tavern or buy Finelli and just fire the cook and hire a real chef and put him in the kitchen.
Oh, Finelli's, that's such a great spot.
Yeah. I there's a sort of famous story where I didn't know what I was doing. So I walked into Finelli's and asked for the owner and said, so you're not doing that well. Do you want to sell your place to me? And I was literally asked to leave, told to leave. So,
Finelli's is that spot in Soho on Prince Street, right?
Mercer,
or
Mercer
Spring.
And Prince.
Yeah,
Mercer
great
and Prince.
Location.
Yeah.
So, how did you and April connect?
Jamie Oliver suggested I meet her. You know, he was a friend I knew from music, from Norman Cook, Fatboy Slim, a friend of mine, a DJ, and so he suggested I meet her and another guy, both of whom were sort of obsessed with America and were thinking of coming to America. And I started emailing with her, and she was like kind of obsessed with Chez Panisse and wanted to spend 6 months or a year or a bunch of time in Berkeley. And I said, well, why don't you stop in New York and spend a few years in New York on the way? And then Mario, who's our partner in the Spotted Pig, you know, he and I said, let's bring her to New York and meet her. And she came to New York. And
she had been at the River Cafe. Right.
She'd been at like all the great places that I used to love when I lived in London for 3 years. I mean, she was at River Cafe. She was at Bibendum, this great oyster bar in the old Michelin building. And she was at the Cow, like the gastropub that most influenced the Spotted Pig's look and feel and stuff.
So yeah. Do you remember your first meeting? Was it love at first sight with you and April?
It was love at first email. I loved her just when we were emailing back and forth. She's just a kind of a badass and kind of, we just liked each other, you know, and I mean, Mario said that, you know, he could tell she was great because she had these burns on all over her arms, and that showed him that she was a badass, that she would like reach into hot ovens and stuff like that. So he loved her for that reason, but she just was kind of innocent and didn't really super direct, and I could tell she was really honest, and we just liked each other, and we're so different in every way, you know, that I thought, we both thought that's a good thing. Like she's a professional, and she was then like a professional chef that was used to kind of playing by rules, and I was the opposite. I wanted to like fuck the rules up and not play by any rules. And I think we both felt like this is a good combo, you know. I don't know if Mick and Keith are opposites, but I know that like, or Peter Buck and Michael Stipe, or Johnny and Morrissey is a great example of opposites in every way. But you know, when they got together, they made magic. I mean, you know, Mick and Keith, that's the best example of. Keith's solo records kind of suck, and Mick's solo records really suck. But the Rolling Stones are, you know, Beethoven. They're awesome. So I think April and me the same. If I did something without her, and I've done things without her, and they've never been as fun and never been as exciting. I mean, there's some, not to take away from the places I've done without her, but it's just, there's some kind of magic that happens when we do stuff together that we don't really talk about. It just, there's a push and pull. She's a pro. I'm kind of a amateur when it comes to the restaurant business. And, you know, she wants to kind of push us toward white tablecloths and music lower and maybe backs on chairs, and I'm always like, no, it's a bar, and she understands, and we, I don't know, it ends up, like White Gold's an example of the latest place that it makes no sense. I mean, financially, it makes no sense partnering with Jocelyn and Erica, who we don't even hardly know that well, really. To, you know, it makes no sense, but it's great. And people are lining up, and they're loving the product and screaming for more. And so, yeah.
So I got a, not that I got a sneak peek, there wasn't really much to see but a construction site, but I was in Los Angeles for the taping of our 100th episode, and I went to go visit Curtis Stone and his crew over at Gwen, and they said that your new place is right across the street.
Tell us
about that spot.
It's an iconic Los Angeles watering hole called the Cat and Fiddle, like the most famous British pub in L.A. probably since 82 when it moved from Laurel Canyon, where it had been for like 10, 15 years to where it is now, to where it was. And so I spent a million years. It was a real music business hangout. So I would always, every British band that goes to L.A., like always went to the Cat and Fiddle to get a pint and to watch the soccer match and stuff like that. They'd go early in the morning to watch soccer live. They'd be drinking there at 7 in the morning and stuff. You know, in a city that's got, where it's 72 degrees every day, there's so few outdoor dining places when you think about it. I mean, even like the Chateau Marmont courtyard, they covered. I mean, it's crazy. So, and I'm born and raised in L.A. My mom lives there. My brother lives there. And like, I've always wanted to do something in L.A. And like every other British person, April kind of is obsessed with Southern California and the produce and the weather. So when the Cat and Fiddle lease was up, there was a new landlord that bought this great building it's in, this 1927 Spanish building on Sunset. They came to us and said, we want to do a better British pub. And we said, well, we don't necessarily want to do a British pub. I mean, we've never done that actually. And I don't think we want to do that. April didn't want to just cook British food. She wanted to cook whatever she wanted to cook. And I didn't want to like have to have the design be British pub. So we said, we'd love to take it, but we're going to do whatever we want. And they said, okay. So, yeah, we've taken this place over. It's huge. It's got, like, over 150 seats just in the courtyard. And it's a monster. You know, it's gone way over budget. It's way behind schedule, and we're stressed out. But it's going to be amazing once it opens.
Will April be the chef?
Oh, yeah.
There? Okay.
She'll be the chef, and she'll spend a lot of time in L.A., true to form, we have no idea what we're going to call it, and we'll probably name it like the week before, like we did Salvation Taco and the Breslin. And
did you decide on the cuisine yet, you being April?
I mean, April, I know, has a clear idea in her mind of what it's going to be. It's going to be wood-fired. That's the overall. I don't want to tell you. You can ask her. But I mean, we're, you know,
that's not very revealing. I wouldn't worry.
Yeah, I mean, she's like Beyonce. You know, she wants to announce the night before we open or the morning we open.
She's April Bloomfield.
Yeah, exactly.
That's her prerogative.
And I'm not, you know, I don't need to approve what she does. You know, like when I was an A&R guy in the music business, I didn't have to like, you know, tell the band the bass is too low or the vocals are too high or. You know, it's like, if I'm so smart, I should make my own record. So April can do whatever she wants.
So you said you grew up in Los Angeles. So you're a native?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I grew up in L.A.
And you said your mom, you had a single mom. You're very close to her?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, we grew up. We were talking off air about why do I like women so much? why do I work with them? I guess, yeah, I'm used to like my mom kind of supporting four kids and...
So you're one of four. You mentioned your sister passed away.
Yeah, she passed away from hepatitis C the year the Spotted Pig opened.
That's terrible.
Yeah. It's. I mean, it's hepatitis C is crazy because it stays in your body for years. You know, she had like shared needles in like high school when mm-hmm. she was dabbling with drugs, and she was fine. And then like, oh yeah, I mean, it stays in your body for some. I mean, this was like, you know, years later. This was 30 years later. More 35 years later.
Were you too close?
Yeah, we were really close. Yeah, I was closer with her than my two brothers. Yeah.
Yeah. Where are you in the lineup?
I'm the oldest.
Oh, you're the oldest. Okay. Yeah. Me too. Yeah. I'm the oldest of five. That's why we.
A five. Wow.
That's why we get along.
That's why we get along. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's probably why you cook and I cook.
Do you cook?
I'm not a chef, but I'm a really good cook. That's part of why I became a restaurateur, because so many of my friends, you know, I'm sort of legendary for parties in the Hamptons and barbecues, and I love that kind of stuff. I love being the host. So, yeah, a lot of people over the years would say, you're so good at this, and not so good at the music thing. Why don't you open a restaurant, you know? And a lot of them were sort of people with money that would say that slipped in, if you ever want to open a restaurant, let me know and I'll invest. So I contacted every one of those people, and pretty much all of them invested in the Spotted Pig.
Yeah. We are going to take a quick break, so we will be right back with Ken Friedman after this word from Kerrygold. Fun baking projects planned for this weekend? Be sure to add Kerrygold Pure Irish Butter to your grocery list. Whether you're trying your hand at 4-20 Blackbird's famous pie crust recipe, Dory Greenspan's chocolatey world peace cookies, or Hot Bread Kitchen's garlic naan with green chili, you need quality butter to make these recipes the best they can be. Kerrygold's milk comes from grass-fed cows that graze up to 300 days, making it perfect for all your sweet and savory baking needs. You'll soon know why so many bakers and pastry chefs love Kerrygold butter. Hi, everybody. We're back with Ken Friedman, the restaurateur behind so many of our favorite places, the Spotted Pig, Salvation Burger, Salvation Taco, Tosca, and on and on and on. And he's also partners with the great chef, April Bloomfield. So Ken, as I said, the other thing I want to talk about with you is your time spent managing my favorite band ever, the Smiths. You worked with them at a pretty awful part of their history. You loved them, obviously, but you couldn't save them. They broke up during your time with them.
I mean, look, no one loved them more than me. I thought they were going to be the biggest band in the world. They could have. They had that iconic formula of guitar player singer, you know, kind of androgynous, poetic, you know, singer, kind of cigarette-smoking, drug-taking, you know, guitar player, you know, real male guitar player. I mean, Jagger Richards and Aerosmith had it, and R.E.M. had it. I mean, every rock band kind of has it. Guns N' Roses, you know, they always kind of had a singer that sort of either looked like or sang like or act like a girl, and the guitar player took drugs and dated models and, you know, smoke cigarettes and stuff. So, and musically, same thing. I mean, they, you know, Johnny is a student of rock and roll, is upset, knows everything about has read every book, you know, about everybody. And his dream was to get to know people like Clapton and Keith Richards. And he did, he got to, cause they were such a phenomenon back in the day. So, what was the question again?
Did you kill the Smiths?
No, I mean, look, when I got involved with the Smiths, Johnny and Morrissey were writing songs by mailing tapes to each other. They weren't speaking to each other at that point. So, you know, what I tried to do was get them to agree to like go on tour and do the normal stuff you kind of had to do, and tried to convince them it didn't really matter if they didn't like each other personally, that they loved each other. Like, you know, they love each other, but they don't like each other. That's you think Keith and Mick like each other? No, they love each other, and they know when they go on tour, they probably don't see each other at all except on stage. But so what? You know, we were talking about great partnerships before, like April and me. Like, you know, we don't have to like hang out with each other and stuff, but we agree on everything. But together, for some reason, there's some magic that happens. So, with the Smiths, like I would love them to have still been together now, right? I mean, whether I was the manager or not, just as a fan. I mean, nobody wrote, and I think writes, but I mean, he doesn't write anymore, but nobody wrote lyrics like Morrissey. I mean, and nobody played amazing guitar riffs like Johnny, and Johnny still does. And so, you know, it's only painful in that I couldn't succeed in convincing them to carry on, and you put your differences aside, you know, and carry on just being the Smiths. You know, the Police broke up, I think, because Sting thought, I can make better music/art by myself without these guys. The Smiths probably broke up for partially that reason, but I think more just because personally there was all this, like, they hated each other in the end.
Technically, Johnny broke up the band, right? Is that how it goes?
The way it goes is I helped convince them that they should make a video.
Sheila Takes a Bow, right?
Exactly. Because even though Morrissey, in an interview years before, had said, the Smiths will never make a video. And he said, the Smiths will never use a synthesizer. You know, Morrissey would say stuff that would get press. He was a genius at that. He's like Donald Trump in that way. He didn't need to have a PR person. He was his own PR person. He said shocking things that made headlines. The week that I became the Smiths manager, the NME had like a front page box that said, we regret to inform our readers we have no news on the Smiths this week. So that was the headline. So, you know, so I sat him down and said, look, you're hemming and hawing about going on tour. You've got to leave, then make a video. I mean, there's this thing called MTV in America that people are, kids are watching MTV, like kids in the middle of America. If you make a video, there's a good chance we'll get on MTV, and all of a sudden you'll have a whole new audience. So they went, yep, let's do it. You're right. Long story short, we got a woman called Tamara Davis, who until a few months ago was married to Mike D from the Beastie Boys. That's not why she's famous. She's a great director, great artist, fantastic person. She had done a few videos at that point. She'd done a Depeche Mode video, a Violent Femmes video, and Warner Brothers suggested that she do this video for the Smiths. We flew her to England. Morrissey spent time with her, said, yeah, I like her, I trust her, let's do it. We set up a whole video shoot with Tamara, brought a whole crew from America. And it was going to be the band playing the song live in a theater, a beautiful, ornate theater that we rented at great expense. And Morrissey just didn't show up. Johnny and I went to his house and knocked on the door, and he didn't answer. We knew he was there. We finally convinced him to go do the shoot. So we set it up for the next day, and he didn't show up. Tamara and Johnny and I went to Morrissey's house again, and he was at his mom's house. Long story short, he just changed his mind, didn't want to make the video. So that was when, I mean, Johnny looked at me and I could tell he was done. He was over. He wasn't going to do this anymore. It just was like Morrissey always did that. You know, he was like the Sly Stone of his generation. You know, people would show up to gigs and he just would cancel 5 minutes before. So, yeah. So, but what I suggested to Johnny and Morrissey was don't make any big announcement that you've broken up. You're broken up now. You hate each other even more. But maybe there's a chance that you'll patch it up and get back together. Maybe it's a year, 2 years, you know. Again, the Police never announced they broke up. Sting decided to go do solo stuff, and there's always a chance they're going to come back together. So I sort of copied them. But the Smiths have tried to get back together. Johnny and Morrissey have gone out recently to talk about doing an album and doing remastering their stuff and doing a tour. But it ended up kind of the same. Johnny's told me that they agreed, let's talk, you know, tomorrow, and then Morrissey just goes quiet.
If you had to put money on it, do you think they'll reunite at least for one tour in your lifetime?
No, I'll put money that they never will.
Because
the problem is, even if they agree to, there's a decent chance that Morrissey will change his mind. It's sad. You know, I just don't think he really wants to. I think Johnny does. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe Morrissey gets more pleasure out of his solo stuff. Although he cancels shows all the time. So I don't know what it is about him that I gave up, and I think Johnny's given up trying to figure out like what makes him tick. You know, he's one of the great lyricists and singers and performers and people, really. When he's on, he's the most charming. I mean, it seems like I'm talking about Donald Trump. It's really funny. When he's on, he's so charming, he can charm the pants off of anybody. But then he sort of changes his mind, and then you can't reach him, or he says something crazy to get people to be shocked, so they'll talk about him. I don't know. It's very weird.
So how did you fall into music? I read you went to San Francisco at some point.
I went to UC Berkeley. I was an art major, art history minor. And like everybody in the art department at Berkeley, I was in a punk rock band.
What was your band called?
I was in three different bands, and they all were worse than the next. One was called Flack, F-L-A-K. One was called The Eggs.
That doesn't sound very punk.
Yeah, it wasn't that. It was more it wasn't very. And then the other one was just, it was just me and Bruce, my friend Bruce. We never really had a name. We were kind of performance artists, sort of, and would do crazy kind of gigs in Barrington Hall, which was this legendary, if anybody out there went to Berkeley, you know Barrington Hall was this legendary co-op, like a kind of hippie dorm that was full of artists and drug dealers and musicians and creative people, some of whom were students at Berkeley and some were just kind of fixtures. It's where a lot of the kind of crazy homeless people would wander around talking to themselves, like a guy called Pink Cloud. He lived there in Barrington Hall. The fuck you guy, who just walk around saying fuck you to everyone.
I don't know who that is.
People from Berkeley would know. You know, these guys that wander around Telegraph Avenue, they would all live at Barrington Hall. So I started putting on shows at Barrington Hall, just so my bands could play, because nobody would book them. They were so bad. This was the late 70s, you know, early 80s. So I'm old. So I started putting on all these bands from San Francisco that were like, there was a huge scene happening in San Francisco. Like when punk rock first happened in this country, it was New York and San Francisco. It didn't really happen in other cities till the Damned toured and then the Ramones toured around. That's when like other cities like LA started to discover punk. But San Francisco, because there's so many art students at the Art Institute and the California College of Arts and Crafts and Berkeley and Stanford, there was just punk rock was all art students. So the Dills and Negative Trend and the Avengers and Crime and the Nuns and, you know, all these were all students, friends of mine from school and stuff. And so I would book all them at Barrington Hall. And then I dropped out of college many times. I ended up dropping out, never graduating. And then I started doing shows in San Francisco. And then I would start getting L.A. bands, X and the Go-Go's and the Germs and the Weirdos and the Screamers. So I started doing all these shows in San Francisco. And then I started to do like Iggy Pop and then the Ramones I did. Then I went back to Berkeley for the third time and started doing shows there. I did the Police and did the Talking Heads in Sproul Plaza for free and B-52s for free in Sproul Plaza and Elena Lovitch and Simple Minds and Gang of Four. And
so amazing.
Yeah. So then I was just, at that point, I was like doing shows. I was an artist. So I was a frustrated artist because I wasn't really a great visual artist and I wasn't a great performer. So the way that I sort of creatively expressed myself was producing a show, finding a space and making the posters and, you know, all, collecting the money and all that kind of stuff. And that led to, I ended up working for Bill Graham, the big promoter in San Francisco.
Who's a legend.
Yeah, total legend. And I worked for him but like a lot of things in my life, I just got bored with like working for someone else and just doing one aspect of an artist's career. Like I ultimately always wanted to be the artist. I wanted to get closer to the artist. I wanted to like work with artists. So I wanted to, you know, musicians, bands. So I started I moved to LA, back to LA where I'm from and started managing bands and then ultimately moved to London and met the Smiths, met UB40. So I managed UB40 and the Smiths. I was, you know, 25 living in London, managing these two big bands, not knowing what the hell I was doing, really no idea, but traveling around the world and it was fun and a whirlwind. And
do you miss the music world?
Well, I mean, the music world changed. So I listen to and enjoy music more than I ever did then, because when it was my job, I kind of didn't want to go home and listen to music. I was like sick of it. You know, I wanted silence. I want to talk about anything. Basically, I wanted to go to restaurants. I love food. You know, I love food and wine. And, you know, and I spent so much of my life in clubs. You know, clubs, restaurants are clubs for adults, you know, where you sort of sit instead of stand and you eat and drink. And so traveling the world with bands and stuff, I got a chance to experience great restaurants, great hotels. I was always saying, let's go to this place and that place. And
maybe that's been the secret to your success, that you look at restaurants as clubs for adults and you're really into the entertainment value
totally
behind them.
I get much more excited, sadly. Every morning, we restaurateurs get all these emails with numbers from last night, how we did, you know, how many covers, and percentage of alcohol to food, and beer to wine to spirits to, you know, you know, all kinds of numbers. I really only look at the VIPs that were there. and by the way, I know before I go there who's going to be there, so I can pop by and say hello and you know, act like I was just in the neighborhood. But, you know, I get excited about that. I mean, I just do. You know, I don't, and I get excited about not, you know, we don't talk about it. We don't sort of like go and tell Page Six and stuff. However you tell Page Six, I don't know how you do that. But I love like the friends and friends of friends and celebrities, whether they live in the neighborhood or not, go to our places. It's just, it's kind of exciting, you know.
And you're always chill.
I wasn't always, but the thing that happens is it's not, if I kind of storm in like a bull in a china shop and start screaming at people during service, it doesn't help. It doesn't, all that happens is the staff gets crazy, gets nervous, hates their job. And ultimately, customers can tell. There's like a weird kind of energy in the room when you're screaming at people. It's better to like make a note and tell them later, or even better to tell the GM of the restaurant to make a note and tell them later. It's really, you know, the reason why we have pre-shift meetings at 5 o'clock at our restaurants is you talk about all that stuff before. And you remind them that, you know, they have to say, nice to see you. If it's someone they know, say nice to see you again. If it's a party that comes in at, you know, 1:30 a.m. and they're tired, the staff's tired, they have to not be tired and really say thank you, because that's the people that really pays the bills, the ones that come late and early. So I'm hard on the staff, but I'm always saying to the staff, like, don't worry about me. I'm the last thing, you know, when people get me a glass of wine, like, I'm like, don't worry about me. Worry about all this, you know. You guys have great jobs. You make a lot of money. We don't tell you what to wear. We don't tell you. You don't have to be a restaurant robot. We don't have to give you a speech about, you know, are you still working on that? Are you still enjoying that? Are you, you know, we don't. We just. You can kind of be yourself. If you have tattoos, roll your sleeves up. If you want to pierce your nose, do it. You know, we want the staff in our restaurants to kind of reflect society and not. We don't want to tell them, like, you know, act this. This is what we do. And April is a little more, in the kind of let's have a formula, tell them what to do. As a customer, I always liked kind of kooky bartenders or servers that kind of had personalities and they weren't on a leash. I want to take the leash off and let them be themselves, within reason. I love being in my places. I love it. I walk in and get goosebumps. Like when I walk in a great restaurant, Roberta's, this place we are now, like, first time I came here, and every time I came here, I kind of get goosebumps. It's great. It doesn't make any sense.
Makes no sense.
Right. So it's great. What makes sense is when you're sitting at a table and you get the food, like, it all kind of makes sense. Spotted Pig, et cetera, now White Gold, same kind of thing. It doesn't make any sense when you walk in White Gold, for example, that you don't know, because people are buying meat raw to take home and cook. They're buying cooked food to take home and eat. They're waiting for a table to sit down and eat cooked food there. They just want to get a glass of wine, despite what Pete Wells said in his thing. You can get a glass of wine there, I promise you.
So Los Angeles, you are going home. Is Magic going the strike again for you guys? You've got such a fantastic track record.
I hope so. I think that April and I early on decided, it was probably my idea first, but she wholeheartedly agreed, that we should only do restaurants in places that we really want to spend time in and have some connection to. And or have some connection to. L.A. is great. You know, it's just different than New York. And she knows that and loves that. So we're going to, you know, we're going to have a good time being there. That matters so much, because then the staff is going to love it if we love it. It's just, if we did a restaurant in Dubai or in Las Vegas or in Philadelphia or places that we don't either love or have any connection to, it would just be a job, and we wouldn't want to be, we wouldn't, neither of us would be there. And when we're there, it would just be a job. And she's going to love LA. She loves LA, and she's going to love being there, and I'm going to love being there. So I think, and also it's got a courtyard. It's got a huge courtyard. And
it's a great restaurant scene now, like we were speaking about earlier. LA has just exploded.
It's the best restaurant scene in the country, maybe the world right now. There's great ideas coming out of LA. You know, there's like vegan food that's great. There's vegetarian food that's great. There's, you know, Justa type market / restaurant / bakery / you know, slashers, we call them, that are great, you know. So
it was weird that for a while there was no great LA food scene. It all just sort of,
it's like London. London's like one of the great restaurant towns in the world, but like when I lived in London 25 years ago, it was terrible. There was great pubs and stuff, but there wasn't really great food. I mean, the gastropub thing in London is what help make it. All these young chefs that couldn't afford to lease a space and find investors, they would just go to these old pubs and say, hey, can I take Monday nights over? You know, like promoters. And that's really how the London scene started. In L.A., I think what happened was when you have a bunch of young or old artists, in this case chefs, that have kind of a chip on their shoulder, that's a good thing. I think L.A. was like, everyone talked about San Francisco food and Portland food and Seattle food. And then people were talking about San Diego with all the breweries and then Tijuana. No one was talking about L.A. And I just think there's a lot of chefs with a chip on their shoulder that were like, we're going to prove to the world that we're great. And also, they started to realize the kind of Alice Waters thing, like, the produce from here is amazing. Stop importing stuff. The best produce in the world is here in Southern and Northern California. So it's okay to have American food, you know. I mean, avocado toast is L.A. The avocados are there, the wheat's from everything, you know. You mentioned avocado toast before. I mean, that's like an L.A. thing, you know. And people like Jessica made it like, you know, uplifted it to a place where it's like, you know, a thing that you can make at your house is actually worth driving or getting a Uber to get somewhere else.
And standing on line for an hour.
Right.
I stood on line with April until they saw April, and April got to cut the line. I think I got to cut the line too, but right. We both cut the line.
Right.
You know, we didn't talk about Alice. How did you meet her during your Berkeley days?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh,
you
did.
Oh, I've known her for God years. I mean, I met her in the late 70s. Yeah. Like, yeah.
Did everybody in Berkeley know each other back then, or did you just walk in the Chez Panisse and hang out?
I sort of discovered Chez Panisse because I lived on the north side. I lived right up there. And it was like, I mean, it was already legendary, you know. So, but I would just go there and kind of hang out and drink wine at the bar. And then, you know,
it doesn't sound very punk rock.
It was punk, you know. Living in Berkeley wasn't very punk rock, really. That's why I moved to San Francisco. But I loved and love Berkeley. And the thing about Chez Panisse is it's the first, you know, it's an original. You know, talk about goosebumps. You walk in there and you feel like this is something special going on here, something different than just heating up food and serving it. So, and then when I got to know Alice early on, I mean, this is years ago, she's pretty punk rock. I mean, her ideas are pretty crazy. She does not compromise. She doesn't believe in, you know, she doesn't believe in grass-fed and, you know, corn-finished beef. She believes in grass-fed beef, period. And she doesn't want to import anything. She wants the goat cheese you're eating to be from, like, that goat right over there that you can see, you know. So she doesn't really fuck around with, you know, compromising. And so she's pretty punk rock. She definitely is. And when you see her in her restaurants, she knows exactly what she wants. I mean, I do this too. When you sit with me in one of my restaurants, I'm a nervous wreck. You know, I try not to show it, but if the lighting's a little bit off, or a window needs to be open, or a server, you know, has sweaty armpits, I mean, I notice, and she'll take him aside and say, like, this is, you know, we're trying to do something special here. If you we didn't ask you to put on a tie, but we at least want you to have a clean shirt. I heard her tell someone that once, you know, quietly. She's right. Like, we're trying to do something special here. And New York, more than any place, like, there's so many choices. Like, no one has to go to your restaurants. You better, like, really make it special and, like, act like you came to play, you know? So, yeah, she's pretty punk rock.
On that, there's no way to improve upon that. So on that note, we're going to go to the speed round. We have a few questions for you.
Speed round.
It's easy. Ready?
I haven't taken speeds in high school.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
How do you take it?
With a little bit of either skim or...
Skim?
Skim, yeah.
Why? I feel like skim's a fraud.
Well, I mean, it is a little bit blue, but I'm just trying not to do dairy, and I'm trying to get rid of this flat tire so I can wear bikinis again.
Thank you, Dave.
I knew that was coming. But almond milk. See, I'm going to go on my almond milk rant. Almond milk kind of curdles unless you like shake it up. So if
do you make your own?
Huh? No, never. I always go
as soon
out.
As that came into my mouth, I was like, Ken Friedman does not make his own almond milk.
I like a reason to go out in the morning and get the vibe and see what's going on and see what the thing and just get some air and go out and we just bought a house in Greenport. Like, I ride my bike to the coffee. There's two different coffee places, you know, near us. I want to go there and just like get the vibe. Otherwise, otherwise it's 3 o'clock and I'm right. in my underwear in the house. You know, and nobody wants that.
Sweet or salty?
Salty.
One food you would never eat?
Octopus.
Really?
When I was in Greece years ago, we went out on a boat and caught an octopus, and the octopus was alive and crawling around me and playing with me,
aww.
Looking me in the eye and playing with me and going up my arm, and like it was like a little pet. And then the guy took it and bit it between the eyes and killed it. And I just don't want to eat octopus because I think of that little octopus that I made eye contact with.
If you were trapped on a desert island with one food celebrity, who would it be?
Well, I mean...
Can't be April.
Right. I mean... That's a weird one because, like, if I'm on a desert island, I probably want it to be a mate so we can make kids and make more people. But I don't know. I mean, Alice is one of my favorite food people.
Have to procreate.
Right, okay. So, no, I mean, I love Bourdain because he makes me laugh all the time. I love Eric Repair because he's so handsome that I question my sexuality. Who else do I really want to... That's a good question. Who do I really admire? I mean, I admired Gabrielle Hamilton a lot. I love her food and love her.
Who do you have the most fun with? Comes down to that.
I mean, I drink the most with Mario, and I love him and love his food. But I wouldn't want to be stuck with him anywhere, a desert island or even a party. So, and I'm sure he feels the same. So, that's a good one. I don't know. But yeah, I think.
This is the speed round, just FYI.
Oh, Alice. Alice Waters.
What are you reading right now? Oh, you told us. Johnny Marr's book.
Yeah, I'm reading it. But I'm also finally reading Keith's book, Keith Richards' book. It's a long book, and I've just sort of skimmed it. I'm reading it now because it's just a great book. So, I'm reading Keith's book right now, Keith Richards' book.
If you had a superpower, what would it be?
Make our current president go away and put someone in there that we feel like is our president. I'm not saying I would have him killed, but I would just make him somehow resign and make Mike Pence resign and put someone else in there.
That would be a super duper power.
Yeah, that would be a great power. I wish I had that power.
Well, that is it for today's show. Thank you so much, Ken. I'm really glad we finally got you on the show. And thanks, as always, to our engineer, Dave Tatasciore, and much love to Kerrygold for making this season of Radio Cherry Bomb possible. Kerrygold butter is made in Ireland with milk from grass-fed cows. It's a taste that says 1,000 words. Thank you for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
Yeah, you are.
Hi, I'm Nina Clemente, and I'm the chef and partner at the Smiles d'Alba in Los Angeles. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is bomb? My sous and pastry chef, Zena Scharf. Cooking is a team sport, and she's the Pippin to my Jordan.